The world needs a good, non-addictive, effective analgesic. You know, chances are you'll find it in the natural world if you look hard enough. The world needs a better tranquilizer. You know, if you went through and you collected all 260 plants that this referred to and started screening, you'd probably come up with a pretty good tranquilizer after a while. So the point is that, you know, this information is out there. What's not happening is there needs to be a systematic follow-up to these things. I mean, we talk a lot in the drug discovery game about hit rates. You know, when I was at Shaman Pharmaceuticals, they were always saying, well, what's our hit rate and what's the correlation, you know, to the ethnobotanical data that we're collecting? And I always said, it's a completely ridiculous argument. The hit rate is 100%, right? Because every plant contains allelo chemicals that have biological activity. The question is, do they hit a target that's of therapeutic interest to us? That's a more interesting question. I mean, often they don't. Often they hit a known target or something we're not interested in. But the point is, they all have biological activity. If you took, you can take any plant at random. If you screen it against enough receptors, sooner or later, you're going to get a hit. So the hit rate is 100%. The other thing is that these natural products, these molecular templates that come from the natural world, one of their main things as far as drug discovery is they give synthetic chemists like Sasha ideas. And that, I mean, synthetic chemists, Sasha accepted, tend to be kind of an unimaginative group, you know. They really can't come up with very many ideas, but they can look at the natural compounds and they can say, oh, well, we'll tweak it here and tweak it there and maybe modify its activity, come up with something a little better, with a better selectivity for a given receptor, maybe less toxic, or maybe longer lasting, or something like that. And that's what's going on here. This is just an example. And you have the natural compound here, morphine, which is a non-selecting multi-agonist, agonist. Very good stuff, very important in medicine, right? Important analgesic. But then the synthetic chemical comes along and turns it into naltrindol, or that is the looks at the structure of morphine and comes up with an idea for modifying it. So it incorporates the basic morphine nucleus. And this becomes a delta opiate selective antagonist. So while morphine is a non-selective opiate agonist, hits all the opiate receptors more or less, this is a blocker of one of the opiate receptor subtypes. Very important to be able to introduce that selectivity in the molecule. Another example, cocaine. A central stimulant, a local anesthetic, being used to label the dopamine uptake carrier because it binds very selectively to that important drug, again, of use and abuse. The synthetic chemists come up with CFT. It's an even better label of the dopamine uptake site than cocaine itself, and it's 3 to 10 times more potent than cocaine as a psychomotor stimulant, just what the world needs. Ibocanic acid from a mushroom is an NMDA agonist. The NMDA is N-methylbiaspartate, one of the excitatory amino acid receptors, and this is an agonist of that receptor. So it has, among other things, anesthesia potentiation, and it inhibits tremor and it inhibits emesis. But synthetic chemists come up with AMPA, which is a structural analog of this, and this becomes a potent glutamate bisphosphonate agonist. So basically, the take-home lesson here is that by making relatively trivial modifications in natural compounds, synthetic chemists can tweak their activity. They're rather than selecting for certain substrates, or even turn agonists into antagonists, so they have the opposite effects. And this is part of the game, again, of coming up with new drugs, new therapeutic compounds. But natural products lead the way because they give the chemists the ideas for things to work with. Well, on a more intimate level, you know, you could say that humans really value plants in some sense. If you want to be reductionist about it, humans value plants for the chemicals that they produce, which we find useful for some reason, because we either put them into our bodies or we put them on our bodies,
and we find them useful. Spices, fragrances, cosmetics, drugs, and, of course, food also has to be included in this category. We depend on the biochemical diversity of plants and the biochemical versatility to give us these products which we find indispensable in our economy, in our health maintenance, and in our lifestyle. For example, plants contain flavorful compounds, these terpenoids and polyketides that give spices such as nutmeg and ginger their flavor. Drugs, as we've said, opium poppy is probably the primary example. And another case is they yield pigments, they yield dyes, which we use to dye our clothes or put in cosmetics to put on our own body. Well, I've always thought that one useful way to look at the array of these biological activities and the array of allelochemicals when it comes to thinking about human interaction with plant secondary compounds. In other words, I'm talking not so much about other organisms, I'm talking specifically about the human relationship with plants and how that's chemically mediated via this molecular language that plants speak. And a concept that seems to me to be useful is you can class all these things as sensorotropic chemicals. I don't know if you'll find the term sensorotropic in any dictionary. Probably not, because I coined it. But what I mean there is there are all these allelochemicals from plants impact on our senses in some way. Sensorotropic chemicals are chemical messengers which are produced by plants which transmit their message by interacting with sensory functions in some manner. And this includes pigments, aromatic compounds, spices, flavoring agents, and pharmacologically active compounds such as drugs. And one useful way to think about these sensorotropic chemicals is to picture them arranged along a spectrum. I don't have a slide, but over on this side, you have your sensorotropic chemicals that are utilized primarily as food. In this case, their impact is primarily on the taste receptors and to some degree on the olfactory receptors and also visual. I mean, that's the level on which we interact with food. If it looks good, smells good, and tastes good, you know, it's food. But what gives it those properties is largely the plant secondary compounds that's in the food. Toward the middle of the spectrum, you get compounds which, you know, you get things that sort of, I mean, they're definitely foods, things like chocolate, which is shown here, one of my and Jonathan Ott's favorites in sensorotropic chemicals, are the flavoring agent that gives chocolate its unique qualities. Well, but chocolate also contains alkaloids, which are drugs. Is chocolate a food or a drug? I don't really know. It's actually both. It's a moot point. The point is, they fade into each other. You can't really separate foods on this side and drug and flavors somewhere in the middle and drugs over there. But there is a tendency along the spectrum for pharmacological activity to become more prominent as you get into the more drug-like things. For example, herbs. You go into any herb stall in a third world country, this happens to be in Florencia, Colombia, and there will be any variety of aromatic plants that you can buy from the herb lady, and they'll say, put it in your bath, you know, it's good for this, it's good for that, put it in your bath or make a tea and rub it on your body, you know, and if you want, you can also put it in your salad. I mean, it's definitely a food, but it's also a drug. These herbs are drugs as well as are their medicines. So where is the distinction? And then finally, on the far side of the spectrum, you get an even greater elaboration. You get plants that are more unambiguously drug-like. I mean, they tend to be more toxic. Their active principles tend to target specific receptors. They tend to be a higher molecular weight than the aromatic compounds you find in herbs. And, you know, they're medicinal plants, definitely, but they're still on the spectrum of sensorotropic plants. So, you know, on this spectrum, the foods and the aromatic and fragrant plants, the flavoring plants and the spices and the drugs all sort of really fade into each other. And so, you know, it's not really a valid question to say these things are drugs or foods or flavorings. They're really both, and they're all sensorotropic chemicals. This is supposed to be opium visions. I don't know if you can see it, but this is a Chinese fellow. But another aspect of the use of these pharmacologically active plants, when humans, this is different folk remedies in the marketplace of the ketones. Go into the marketplace and they have these bags of dried plant material set out with their common names of what each one is for. And you can just buy your medicines. You don't go to the pharmacy. And particularly if you're poor, if you're in that economy, you just go to the local herbalist and buy the medicines that you need. And what this is illustrative of, in a way, is that when it comes to the human interaction with plant allelochemicals, we take the plant chemicals, which the plants evolved as defenses or symbiotic chemicals or fragrances or whatever for its own purposes, and we put those chemicals to our purposes. We make a deliberate implementation of an allelochemical interaction to achieve some desired therapeutic effect. Now, the plant didn't evolve these things so that we could use them. We happen to find these chemicals useful for our purposes. So there's an element here of human intervention, of human adaptation of an allelochemical to serve a purpose that may be very different from the reason that the plant originally evolved that particular compound. But this can have profound influences both on the humans that utilize the plant and on the plants themselves. For example, this is Diastorea, which is the source of complex plant steroids. And in the plant, the steroid compounds that are found in this probably serve an effect, a defensive function, because they can interfere with insect molting, and they can interfere with the development of the insect life cycle and essentially protect the plant against being decimated by insects by interfering in the molting process. The insect eats the steroid and that basically throws a whole monkey wrench in its life cycle. However, humans come along and take the same plant and extract the steroids out of it and turn it into an effective oral contraceptive. This is far removed from the ecological function it served in protecting the plant, but the human use of the steroid has greater evolutionary consequences for the plant, greater long-term consequences, because it leads us to domesticate the Dioscorea, to cultivate it, to install plantations of it so that we can get this valuable chemical out of it, and that affects the future evolution of the plant. What's happened to the plant is it's become domesticated, and that is going to affect it for as long as the species exists, as long as we still find it useful. The development of these agricultural techniques, which was kind of an enhancement of this allelochemically mediated interaction or relationship between humans and plants, led us to evolve from a nomadic foraging lifestyle to a sedentary lifestyle. And cultivated plants, instead of primary plants, became the source of our basic necessities. And this literally, this rooting of formerly nomadic populations to permanently inhabited sites where crop cultivation took place season after season and year after year led first to the establishment of villages, eventually city-states with larger populations, division of labor, complex political organizations, systems of law, science, technology, based largely on the storage and transmission of written information. But it was the invention of agriculture, the first real formalization of the plant-human symbiosis, which defined a relationship between humans as plants and plants as something qualitatively different from from simple foraging of herbivores on plant populations. It was this formalization of the relationship, the creation of domesticated plants, that made possible the milieu in which civilization arose and could flourish. And if this process had a profound impact on human culture, it also had an equally profound impact on the food and medicinal plants, which were the basis of this agricultural revolution. This establishment of sedentary agriculture set the stage for the process of plant domestication and selective breeding. Initially, this was an empirical process, an empirical human activity based largely on observation and trial and error. Farmers would unwittingly select for those specimens which displayed an enhancement of some desirable property, a sweeter or larger fruit, an unusual pigmentation, a pungent fragrance, a less bitter taste, a more bitter taste, indicating high levels of alkaloids. Who knows? Basically, this process is a process of modifying the chemical properties of the plant to suit our purposes, to increase the biosynthesis of those secondary compounds we consider important, or to lessen them, to get rid of the bitter ones, and that sort of thing. So this led to the development of cultivars. Plant cultivars are basically genetic monstrosities, such as shown here. They don't occur in nature. They couldn't survive in nature. They're entirely dependent on human propagation in order to exist. And most of our major food plants are cultivars, and most of our major medicinal plants as well. Cannabis sativa is a good example. It probably doesn't even exist in the wild state. There are many different strains, many different cultigens that we have bred over thousands of years for different purposes: oil, fiber, and resin. But the cannabis is a good illustration of a plant that is basically almost entirely exists as a cultivar now. Salvia divinorum may be a similar example. Tobacco is another one. Actually, that wasn't tobacco. That was belladonna. In fact, one ethnobiologist even suggested that the pharmacological utilization of plants could not appear as a specialized branch of human knowledge until the ongoing process of plant domestication had led to the development of cultivars with reduced levels of allelochemicals compared to the wild types. And this happened as centers of civilization grew up and people began living in more concentrated areas. You had sanitation problems and transmission of disease problems. His theory was that as long as you were eating wild plants with low levels, or with you had a certain constant level of allelochemicals in your system, this was protecting you from infection. When these people started eating domesticated plants, they became more susceptible to disease. Their immune systems were not as stimulated by these allelochemicals. So it then became necessary to go out and gather medicinal plants and reintroduce them into the diet, because the cultivated plants were no longer providing the protection that they required. Now we hear about people.
Yeah.
Timothy Johns, do you know his work? He wrote a book called With Bitter Herbs They Shall Eat It, which is a very interesting, which is a quote from the Bible, some part, a very interesting study of the importance of allelochemicals and the way that allelochemicals have mediated plant domestication. He started out doing his work on potato cultivars, believe it or not, in the Andes, and then from that, looking at how these less toxic varieties of potato became domesticated and integrated into cultivation, came up with these ideas. Very interesting book. Well, now they're talking about using plants to do, to carry this one step further, not just breeding plants to modify their chemical properties, but actually breeding through molecular engineering, through genetic engineering. They're talking about breeding plants to produce things like plastics within the plant, and
you know, I've even heard it said that maybe we can get them to produce manufactured products. So instead of buying your VCR in the store, you just go pluck it off the tree. Well, I mean, we're a bit far from that, but this is in principle just a further extension. I mean, I don't see anything unnatural about it. It's, if we can get the plant to do it, okay. I mean, we and the plant, you know, it's a reciprocal give and take relationship.
Well, I think the argument,
now I'm sort of speculating, moving more into the area of speculation, I think the notion that humans have influenced the evolution of plants profoundly, you know, we can all sort of accept that, because clearly we've domesticated plants, and in the process of domesticating them, we've modified their forms and their chemistry, and we've modified them in ways that are desirable to us, that enhances their usefulness or appeal to us in some way. The other side of the coin is not so clear, you know, and this is the part that I want to kind of speculate on, but you know, we know that we have influenced the plants. The question is, how much of the plants influenced us in our evolution? And is there any evidence that they have been? Certainly in the iconography of artists, we get suggestions that the feeling that there is a more intimate association between plants and humans that we might like to acknowledge. This is a plant man. I'm not sure who did the painting.
Archimboldo.
Huh? Yeah?
Archimboldo.
This is a mandrake.
Sorry, it's not.
The mushroom shaman of the Sasali Plain. I mean, we've all seen this, I'm sure, many times. What these images basically suggest is, you know, maybe humans and plants are not that far apart.
Maybe there is an even more intimate symbiosis than we realize. And could this symbiosis, and perhaps even the evolution of humans into what we are, have been influenced somehow by plant allelochemicals in some way? The interesting thing is that humans and the precursors to humans have been interacting with these plant allelochemicals. They've been chewing them, snorting them, smoking them, brewing them, and otherwise ingesting them for 65 million years or so, give or take a few, which is basically when the angiosperms began to flower and became really widespread. The gymnosperms and seedless plants don't have secondary chemicals, but the angiosperms really carried it to sort of its level of complexity that we see now. So is it possible that this long association between mammals, between herbivores, and physiologically active allelochemicals might have evolutionary consequences for primates and us? I mean, we evolved from the primates. Certainly this is well known in insects. It's known that chemically mediated coevolution between plants and insects profoundly affected the chemistry and physiology of both. So similar processes of biochemical adaptation may have gone on between plants and plant-consuming mammals, including primates. The evolution of complex secondary compounds, particularly alkaloids, in the angiosperms, and the concomitant evolution of mammals may have been related. It seems likely that early in the evolution of mammals, tens of millions of years before anything even resembling humans appeared in the evolutionary scene, the process of biochemical and genetic adaptations to plant toxins was working subtle changes in mammalian physiology, creating selection pressure for toxin resistance, biochemical adaptations involving the evolution of multiple substrate, highly efficient inducible enzyme systems, such as the amine oxidases and the cytochrome P450 microsomal enzyme systems. These are essentially mammalian adaptations to metabolizing these plant allelochemicals, to neutralizing these allelochemicals. This is part of the biochemical warfare that we were talking about. Constant low levels of these allelotropic and psychotropic plant chemicals in the diet of foraging primates or early humans could certainly have affected their phenotypic biochemical adaptations. They could also have affected their immune, genetic, and sensory and cognitive functions. For example, many plant toxins are mutagens, and they can impact on the inheritance process directly if they should cause mutations in the germ cells, in the egg or the sperm. Unfortunately, as far as we understand evolution, the majority of mutations are detrimental. But from these, some are favored by selection and result in evolutionary adaptations, and those flourish. So it's possible that over many generations, a constant exposure to low levels of mutagens in the diet might have contributed to enhanced mutation rates or enhanced genetic drift of a population, so that perhaps over time the mutation rate was actually accelerated, and so the overall rate of evolution was accelerated. Another area where plant allelochemicals could have had an effect is in the modulation of our immune systems. These dietary allelochemicals could have directly affected the immune response of primates. There's been some recent work published in Germany in which the effects of extremely small doses of toxic alkaloids and other allelochemicals on immune functions was investigated. These were 100 to 1,000 times less than what we consider the pharmacologically active dose, much less than any dose thought to cause any toxicity or really any kind of response at all. But what these people found was that at these vanishingly small doses, 10 to the minus 12 molar and lower, right? So down in the picomolar and femtomolar ranges, many of these compounds caused a very strong activation of the nonspecific immune system. When these doses were increased to putatively therapeutic doses, the level of cytotoxicity or whatever, they became immune suppressants. They became strong immune suppressants. So these investigators, their interest was to explain the mechanism of action of homeopathic medicines. And they felt that this perhaps explained it, that these extremely dilute homeopathic medicines working at 10 to the minus 12 molar and lower concentrations cause the stimulation of the nonspecific immune system. But the relevance of this finding for the present argument is that these chronic low levels of these dietary allelochemicals could have functioned to potentiate the immune functions of certain individuals, thus conferring a greater resistance to disease, longer life, enhanced reproductive potential, and all the evolutionary consequences, all the evolutionary advantages for those that foraged on these immunostimulating allelochemicals. Again, it's probably hard to test this hypothesis, but it's a reasonable notion. One of the puzzles of evolution, certainly, in the evolution of primate, is the explosive evolution of the human neural hardware. The size of the human brain tripled in a mere 3 million years, during which time we went from languageless, tool-less, four-legged primates to two-legged, tool-wielding, verbally expressive, and deity-worshipping human beings. All this happened while the invention of writing was still 100,000 years in the future. Of course, everyone knows that the fossil record is full of gaps. But it still is the most tangible physical evidence we have that something very peculiar was going on in hominid evolution since about 3 million years ago. That date, more or less, give or take 500,000 years, marks the appearance of Homo habilis, the first unmistakably human primate. The first proto-human probably walked upright, may have used simple tools, and displays a dramatic increase in cranial capacity and brain size relative to his close cousin, Australopithecus bosii. The most remarkable fossil, this one here, ER1470, has been dated somewhere between 2 and 2.8 million years. ER1470 has a cranial capacity of 780 cubic centimeters, nearly twice that of the contemporary Australopithecus africanus, which is shown here, and even larger than other Homo habilis species. This guy, essentially, is like us, but he lived 3 million years ago. So it shows that, something evolutionary pressure was going on about that time out on the Serengeti Plain in Africa, where all this stuff was taking place. What caused this explosive expansion of the human neural capacity, of the complexity of the human brain? Well, one of the anomalies of our existence is that we are very much unlike any other species that inhabits this planet. We're the only species with a complex language. We're the only technology-utilizing species. We're the only species able to store accumulated knowledge in a symbolic form external to ourselves. We're the only species for whom symbols, which are ideas of abstractions, have as great a reality as physical objects. This preoccupation with symbols, with abstractions, is the cause and the result of human culture. And it is culture, this abstract edifice composed of symbols, composed of art, science, medicine, artifice, myth, folklore, all of these things are symbolic structures that truly sets us apart from biological species. So, yes, I mean, we're part of nature, but we're also quite anomalous. Our species is unique in having these symbolic functions.
At the same time, it's clear that much of this symbolic underpinning that carries our civilization forward and that makes us what we are is derived from, or perhaps the inevitable result of, the extraordinary complexity of the human brain, the complexity of our nervous system.